Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari.
Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari.
Jai Radha.
Bye.
Chapter 14, The Forest of Enjoyment, Text 10. We'll, since this is prose, we'll just read the word for word. Quachit, sometimes. Sakrit, once. Avagata Vishaya, Vaitatya, becoming conscious of the uselessness of enjoying material sense gratification. Swayam himself. Para abhijanena. By the bodily concept of the self. Vibram shita. Destroyed. Smriti. Whose remembrance? Taya. By that. Eva, certainly. Manichitoya, water in a mirage. Prayan, similar to. Tan, those sense objects. Eva, certainly. Abhitavati, runs after. Translation. The conditioned soul sometimes personally experiences the futility of sense enjoyment in the material world. And he sometimes considers material enjoyment to be full of miseries. However, due to his strong bodily conception, his memory is destroyed. And again, he runs after material enjoyment just as an animal runs after a mirage in the desert. Purport. The main disease in material life is the bodily conception. Being baffled again and again in material activity, the conditioned soul temporarily thinks of the futility of material enjoyment. But he again tries the same thing. By the association of devotees, a person may become convinced of the material futility. But he cannot give up his engagement, although he is very eager to return home back to Godhead. Under these circumstances, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in everyone's heart, compassionately takes away all the material possessions of such a devotee. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, Yasyaham Anigranami Harishye Tadhanam Shanai. Lord Krishna says that he takes everything away from a devotee whom he especially favors when that devotee is overly attached to material possessions. When everything is taken away, the devotee feels helpless and frustrated in society, friendship, and love. He feels that his family does not care for him any longer, and he therefore completely surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. This is a special favor granted by the Lord to a devotee who cannot fully surrender to the Lord due to a strong bodily conception. As explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Ami vidya e mukte vishoy kene dipa. The Lord understands the devotee who hesitates to engage in the Lord's service, not knowing whether he should again try to revive his material life. After repeated attempts and failures, he fully surrenders to the lotus feet of the Lord. The Lord then gives him directions. And attaining happiness, he forgets all material engagement. Translation again. The conditioned soul sometimes personally appreciates the futility of sense enjoyment in the material world. And he sometimes considers material enjoyment to be full of miseries. However, due to his strong bodily conception, his memory is destroyed, and again, he runs after material enjoyment, just as an animal runs after a mirage in the desert. Om Ajnanachirmanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshudaritam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. What you should immediately get from this verse and purport is the conviction that Krishna understands you. He understands your hesitations, and therefore he's working in your heart to deal with you in such a way that you gradually get over material existence. Krishna, as we often repeat from Srimad Bhagavatam purport, Krishna is not lazy in your heart. He is not cold, impersonal, and unresponsive. He knows how to treat his devotees. This is described elsewhere in the fifth canto, as well as in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna says, look at my devotee. He or she wants to serve me while at the same time holding on to material desires. This is like a person who wants to drink nectar while at the same time drinking poison. This doesn't make any sense, in other words. So what am I going to do? I'm not unintelligent. I know how to handle such cases. Because a person is serving me, even though the person has material desires, I'll treat him in such a way that those desires will go away, and instead, he or she will take full shelter of my lotus feet. Or put another way, Krishna says, I'll fulfill those material desires in such a way that my devotee will never ask for this again. So as we may have spoken here before, we may be a little afraid of this. Wait a minute now. I like it that Krishna fulfills my material desires, but that he does it in a way that I'll never ask for that thing again? That sounds scary. Think of it in this way, that Krishna will give you shelter at his lotus feet in such a way that you'll forget all those desires. That sounds better, doesn't it? You don't want anything yanked away from you. You'd just like it to slide off very gracefully. Actually, material existence is not a graceful experience, in case you haven't noticed. It's full of all kinds of roller coaster rides, extremes of happiness and distress, boredom, frustration, bewilderment. Yet, because we're attached to it, we fear being separated quickly from it. And why are we attached to material existence? Because we are attached to the body. Our big problem is bodyism. As Prabhupada begins the purport, he says, the main disease in material life is the bodily conception. Being baffled again and again in material activity, the conditioned soul temporarily thinks of the futility of material enjoyment. But again, he tries the same thing. So this is a story of our sojourn through material existence, one body after another. Sometimes we get frustrated, but then we get right back to business as usual. The same old song. Body after body. Birth after birth. Situation after situation. In other words, even though we get some realization, this is futile, or why am I working so hard? Or why am I trying to squeeze fulfillment out of this temporary body? Why am I doing that? But overpowered by bodyism, we again get right back to business as usual. This is a great wonder of the world. How, and even though we're defeated, bewildered, impeded, and have some realization, this is not worth it. What's the point of all this? What's the purpose? Still, we get right back to the same old business. It's a situation that can only be remedied by divine intervention. And that's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivi esha gunamai mamamaya duratyaya mamevaye prapadyante maya metam tarantite. This material energy of mine, the mirage, is practically impossible to overcome unless you do things Krishna's way, unless you take Krishna's plan. We get so fascinated and mesmerized just by some temporary success, right? If things go our way for a few days, oh, we're so delighted. If someone shows us a little bit of understanding and appreciation, our head spins, right? Oh, life is good. We want fulfillment of our material aspirations. We want entertainment for our body and mind. We want appreciation. And we want, most of all, to be loved, and we want to love. So unless bhakti handles all these aspirations, how can it be effective? So this is why, in the second canto, the Bhagavatam verse is there. Akama, sarvakama, moksha kama, udharati. Whether you are full of material desires, free of all material desires, or lusty for liberation, engage in devotional service with the concentrated strength of a sunbeam, a ray of sunlight, fully focused. Our bhakti process is for all kinds of people, whether they are free of material desires or full of material desires. In the association of devotees, if that association is potent, people will make advancement. Devotees will make advancement beyond their material aspirations. So this is a therapeutic process. And we are all in need of therapy. Material existence is the symptom of madness. We're seeking fulfillment in matter or material arrangements. And in this way, the spirit soul becomes lost deep in the forest of material enjoyment. You enter into the deep forest looking for profit. There'll be some valuable roots or minerals or some kind of natural resources. Who knows, maybe you'll stumble on a gold mine. Who knows? Maybe some oil you could sell before the price totally collapses. You're hoping, as you wander deep into the forest, you're hoping to make some extraordinary discoveries. And if you have a few other persons with you wandering in the deep forest, you think, I'm safe. Here are my associates. Together, we'll help each other. As you go deeper and deeper into the forest, sometimes you realize, actually, We don't know where we're going. We don't know where we are. We are bewildered. And then someone amongst you will say, no, 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 just keep going, keep going. It'll be right. She'll be right. Keep going. Oh, okay. Yeah. According to our different cultures, that kind of response will come in different ways. Do the right thing now. Do your duty. This is what your parents, this is what your grandparents did. This is what every respectable person does, so you must do it without question. If you're from one culture, you'll get a response like that. If you're from another culture, just do what you want. That's what everyone's doing. How do you feel right at this moment? Just enjoy right now. That is your obligation. That is your debt. To do whatever pleases you right now. Because everyone is doing that. To admit that we're bewildered deep in the forest takes some integrity. I was speaking last night to a fine group of persons approaching bhakti, beginning their bhakti practice, from Australia, UK, China, and some of them were admitting, even though they're in the prime of their life, they're in their 20s, they were admitting, what's the point of all this struggle? Even when I'm in so-called enjoyable circumstances or events, I just wonder. There's no freshness. What's the point? So I explained to them that they are at a very fortunate stage of their journey through the cosmos. They are materially fatigued. And the proof of that fatigue is that they're questioning. Even though they're in their 20s. They're not homeless persons. They're not down and outers. They're, you could say, the so-called average person who's living his or her life and whilst doing what everyone else does, thoughts are coming to them like, is this all there is? Is this for real? So again, I explained to them, you're at a very fortunate stage. After many births and deaths, wandering through countless lifetimes of different bodies, you develop this fatigue. But although that stage of material exhaustion is so rare, still, it's not automatic that from that stage you will climb onto the spiritual platform. Even though that stage of material fatigue is rare, still you have options. You don't have to choose the Krishna route. Even though Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the Krishna route is the only way out. But you don't have to choose that. You can just become cynical and frustrated more. You can dive into intoxication, which is considered a required nutrition these days. So it's, although this stage you're at of material fatigue is so rare and fortunate, you still have to make some major decisions. Are you going to understand that your material fatigue and bewilderment is due to a lack of authorized knowledge? Or will you just say, anyway, who can figure this out? Life, who knows? Just got to do the best you can. Material enjoyment isn't all that everyone's made it out to be, but it seems to be the only game in town. So you've got to become even more fortunate. That was my point to them. You've got to push on through this stage of material fatigue and exhaustion, as you wander the forest of material enjoyment, and you're realizing, I'm baffled. I'm getting exhausted. What's the point of this? I was searching for jewels and gold and natural resources in the forest, and I can't understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. You've got to push on to a higher level. Don't push on wandering through the forest of material enjoyment. Push on to a higher level. Take shelter of authentic knowledge. That you're exhausted and bewildered means insufficient knowledge. Bhakti is a wisdom culture. And that wisdom of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam is transformative, it's dynamic, it's active. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, in the fourth chapter, Krishna talks about knowledge in such action terminology. Nahi gyanena sadrasam. There's nothing that compares to transcendental knowledge, knowledge beyond the modes of material nature. Nothing compares to that. And sarva gyana plavenaiva. When you're situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, you'll cross over the ocean of material suffering. What else? The fire of transcendental knowledge burns all the sinful reactions. So these are not passive presentations of what the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita can do. Generally, people think that knowledge is just some kind of belief. It's all relative. You may think this, someone else thinks that. When they associate with devotees, however, they see that the knowledge is actually producing change. The bodyism slackens. And that bodyism is such a foe. It's so ingrained in us. It seems second nature to us just to be the body and try to please the body. To identify with the body, to identify others with the body. This seems so appropriate. Now, there's a reason for this that traces all the way back to Goloka Vrindavan. In Goloka Vrindavan, in Krishna Leela, everyone is their body. There is no difference between the body and the self. In terms of Krishna, and Krishna's devotees. And in order to taste the topmost enjoyment, Krishna has bodily relatives. Because some want to love him in that way, so Krishna gives them a slot. All right, you can act as my mother. Of course, there's only one Mother Yashoda and only one Nanda Maharaj. But there can be countless, unlimited devotees, residents of Goloka Vrindavan, who have Vatsalya Prema, parental love of Krishna. Even Putana was given that slot. Because, as you know, she tried to feed her poison breast to baby Krishna. He killed her, but he also gave her a position in Goloka Vrindavan, equal to his mother, meaning the same flavor, Vatsalya Prema. So, there's bodily conception in Goloka Vrindavan, but there everyone is the body. And it's kind of nice. Mother Yashoda, and Krishna has his aunties, he has his uncles, he has his cousins. It's nice. Everyone is relishing some kind of relationship with Krishna there. Whether related to him by family or not. Of course, spiritually everyone's related to Krishna. But because family and body identification has some happiness. Krishna takes it up. The problem, though, is when that's reflected into the material world, what is pleasing in Goloka Vrindavan becomes problematic in the kingdom of Maya. So because there is genuine satisfaction, unending satisfaction for the family ties of Krishna and Goloka Vrindavan, that satisfaction pervertedly reflects into the material world, and we strive for it. I want my people, my friends, those who are in relation to my skin. Those are the kind of people I want around me. Those are the kind of people I want in my neighborhood. As you know, material existence is the perverted reflection of the spiritual world. So in the material world, the bodily conception, bodyism, is completely problematic. Of course, if you can use body connections for the purpose of serving Krishna, all right, that is yukta vairagya. Taking something that in of itself has no value, but attaching it to Krishna's service, then it has value. So therefore, families that have Krishna in the center utilize their body connection in order to bring about an increase in Krishna's service. That is for real. As Srila Prabhupada would often point out, if you're an impersonalist, if you're a Mayavadi, there's no question of family affairs. It's all illusion. But we know that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, who's a family man and a military man. Krishna's doing this on purpose to show you that bhakti yoga can proceed in any circumstance of life, especially circumstances you normally consider to be binding and bewildering. Krishna's saying no. As he told Arjuna, mam anusmara yujam cha, fight and think of me. He didn't say, sleep in the back of the chariot and I'll do everything. So be active and think of me. This bodyism is so strong that even someone who comes to bhakti may have a relapse. You see it happening. And by this bodyism, the memory is destroyed. So it's not an innocent thing to identify with your body. Well, some identify with the body, some don't, some more, some less. Anyway, we're all believers. We all share the same religious belief. That's the main thing. No, bodyism destroys your intelligence. And when your intelligence is lost, down you go into the material pool. So we always have to be on guard about that, how bodyism is creeping in under the door, through the window cracks, through the holes in the roof, it comes. Late at night while you're sleeping, bodyism comes creeping. It's like that. We're always having to be on guard. And sometimes we resent always having to be on guard, yes? Sometimes it seems like material life is so carefree and no worries made. But to be a devotee, you always have to be worried about Maya. Is this Maya? Is that Maya? What about the spices they gave me in the prasad for Ekadasi? Does it have it in the base of the spices? Were there any grains? Oh no! They did this to Prabhupada, by the way. One devotee cooked lunch for Prabhupada and served it to Prabhupada. He told me this personally. And Prabhupada was eating lunch, and all of a sudden the devotee who was in the kitchen waiting for Prabhupada to finish
comes running in. Oh no, Prabhupada, I've done it. Oh no, I made a horrible mistake. Prabhupada said, well, what is that? Oh, the sabji.
Yes, was very good.
Oh, but I used hing, and hing has a corn base. Prabhupada looked at him and said, we are not fanatics. He told me this himself.
Sometimes we mistake ekadasi for an exercise in botanical prowess.
Right? You know, right? You really get into it, you know?
The purpose of ekadasi is no grains, no beans, and increase your glorification of Krishna. That part we forget. Glorification of Krishna, how it should increase. So anyway, we want to be careful. We're not criticizing those who want to be careful. We're just using that as an example of how we're always on guard. And sometimes, no matter what culture you're from, still you have this notion that the bhakti life is constricting. There are things to do and things not to do. You see, no matter what culture you're from, you have this desire for freedom, for no restrictions around you. And so you always are looking for that. When can I just be me and act according to what I want? My choices, my options. That's expressed in different ways depending on what part of the world you're from, but it's still there in everyone. Why is it there in everyone? This love for freedom? It's because we are eternally free in our original constitutional position. Freedom doesn't mean without Krishna. Freedom means to love Krishna, and Krishna responds in the way that we want to love him. That's the freedom. Throughout the whole world, because of bodhism, there's such a misunderstanding as to what freedom is. It's like in the USA. We're taught to sing songs as soon as we're starting school. From every mountaintop, let freedom ring. I were taught one, the words of one, what they call in the USA, the Revolutionary War. That was the battle against the colonizers, England, so that the original colonies in the USA could be free. They presented as a revolutionary war for freedom, but actually, simply, the people in the colonies didn't want to pay taxes. That's the only reason. Of course, Purvai Swami tells me that here in Australia, you all voted in GST. Bring it on! Bring on the taxes! But anyway, so they have in the USA what they call the Revolutionary War. It's actually just, we don't want to pay taxes for tea. So, the school kids are taught the Revolutionary War heroes. There was one named Patrick Henry. And he had to memorize his shlokas, his mantras, as a little school kid. His most famous one is, give me liberty or give me death. Regardless of your culture, everyone has this longing just to express themselves without inhibition. Just like now in India, they're tasting the Western version of freedom. What is all this constricting family structure? You have to marry who your parents suggest you marry. You have to be good until marriage. Unless you're on your own laptop or smartphone, then you can look at what you like and no one knows. But anyway, except for that, you're supposed to be good until marriage, and you have to do the right thing. And I always tell when we have weekend retreats with the students overseas students from India and the young professionals who've been established in Australia for a few years, I always say, I know what you're thinking. Here you are in Australia, and finally you can experiment with no one watching you. Everyone looks down at the ground like... You're looking at the Aussies and thinking, oh yeah, so carefree, no worries, mate. Hey, well, you got to give it a go. And of course, I always add, I know you tell yourself, I won't go as far as them, of course. We'll do it the Indian way. But degradation is degradation. There's the submarine theory. You know the submarine theory? Submarines can descend beneath the surface of the ocean to a certain depth and hold right there and not go down any further. So the submarine theory conception of Maya is that I'll do Indian Maya. I'll just go down 1 kilometer below and I'll hold right there. I won't go rock bottom to the bottom of the ocean like others, like other peoples. So that theory seems inviting. It's part of the bewilderment in the forest of material enjoyment. One of the bewildering items is the submarine theory. So the illusory energy broadcasting in your head says, yes, you're right. Just come down into degradation a little bit. I promise you, you'll hold right there. You won't go any lower. And of course, you're dealing with Maya, whose only purpose is to bewilder you. So you do that. You think, I'm going down this depth. I'll hold right there. I won't go like those other people. How do they do it? No way. A little bit, though, just to be open-minded, you know, a little bit of illusion will do you no harm, you know. Get it all out of your system before you're married, you know. And then what happens? You go down 1 kilometer below the surface of the ocean, and then the illusory energy gets in your head. Well, why don't you come down another kilometer? You came down 1 kilometer and lightning didn't strike you. You're still alive. You still go to the temple on Janmashtami. What's the problem? You put something in the hundi 3 months ago. So come on down another kilometer. And before you know it, you've crashed on the bottom of the ocean. And then you even have the nerve to question the illusory energy. Maya, why did you do this? Because I'm Maya. So sometimes we become disturbed that there seem to be so many restrictions and protocols and procedures for bhakti, which there aren't. Yet, we'll go to our workplace and submit to so many protocols and procedures. Even when we're working at home, you're monitored. You've got to complete a certain amount of work at home. For material purposes, we'll slave. But for Krishna, I don't know, so many restrictions. You can't do this, can't do that. Can't have onions or garlic. And, so many requirements. But for material life, we're wide open for any kind of restriction. Make me a wage slave, whatever. Tell me what to do. Just pay me. Whereas Krishna wants to reward us with the salary of ecstatic love of Krishna. As Chaitanya Charitamrita explains, just one drop of pure love for Krishna can drown the whole universe. Just one drop. So we're dealing with the most precious commodity. And yes, we have to always be mindful that true freedom cannot be found on the material platform. The material platform is a disease platform, and we need to take our therapy. We need to go through our therapy. get over the disease.
And then you can be free on the spiritual platform. Real freedom simply means to love Krishna in the way that's natural for you, and Krishna will respond. Even you're attached to a particular form of Krishna, he'll appear in your heart, on the lotus of your heart, in that very form that you're attached to. There's the freedom. So we should be grateful that we can always consider what is best for Krishna's service, what is best for my spiritual life. There's one saying that the price of real freedom is vigilance. That means being on guard all the time. It's not an inconvenience to be on guard all the time. It's a privilege. You have the greatest jewel, so you have to be careful in your protecting it. So as this verse is telling us, the conditioned soul sometimes personally appreciates the futility of sense enjoyment in the material world. And he sometimes considers material enjoyment to be full of miseries. However, due to his strong bodily conception, his memory is destroyed. And again, he runs after material enjoyment just as an animal runs after a mirage in the desert. So you might say, well, what hope is there? Who is completely free from bodyism? Sounds like I'm doomed. Due to strong bodyism, my memory will fade. I'll get back to the same thing again. No, this is why we need Krishna's mercy. And Krishna's mercy comes to us through the association of devotees and opportunities to serve Krishna in the association of devotees. So if you want to safeguard yourself from bodyism, you must have active engagement in Krishna's service. As you all know, devotional service begins with the tongue, seva mukhi jivana, and it involves all the resources of our life. How can they be used for Krishna's pleasure? As Srimad Bhagavatam says, pranaya artaya dhiya vacha. Your life energy, your prana, arta, your wealth, dhiya, your intelligence, vacha, your words. One of those, best would be all of them. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings, Manasa Deha Geha Yogi Chumur, Arpinin Tuya Pari Nand Kishore. Oh, Nand Kishore, everything I have, mind, body, home, it's all yours. That is the royal road to success in defeating bodyism. Otherwise, without an active, dynamic program of keeping Krishna in the center of our life, our family life, you can be sure that somehow that the bodyism will try to recapture you. It's just a fact of existence. It's just the way the environment of the material existence is set up. But we can cross over that simply by taking more shelter of Krishna. So in this way, actually, the illusory energy is motivating us to push ourselves faster to Krishna. You can utilize Maya in that way. When the illusory energy knocks on your door, in various forms of bodyism, even the subtle forms of prestige, respect, acclaim, when that happens, you realize, I need more bhakti. You transform these threats into an opportunity to take more shelter of Krishna. So this is how skillful bhakti is. A devotee is expert because a devotee knows how to even use attacks of illusory energy in Krishna's service. So this chapter, The Forest of Material Enjoyment,
as we explained last week, is an elucidation of the previous chapter, in which the concepts of this extended allegory were first presented. But Rahu Ganamaraj wants to understand more. He's eager. Can you go deeper? Can you explain this allegory even more than you've already done? I'm so eager to hear. And so Judd Bart is now giving you a deeper elucidation, a deeper explanation of this forest of material enjoyment allegory, deeper than he gave in the preceding chapter, chapter 13. And some of the examples given, as we explained a little bit last week, could make you feel a little uncomfortable about the tigers by day and witches by night, and the family members, the wife and children are plunderers. But that's the material reality. Hopefully yours is not that reality. But still, the Bhagavatam is doing you the eternal service of pointing out things that normally you wouldn't like to look at, and getting you to see existence in the material body and in the material world from all different angles. So we appreciate. We don't become resentful. Why is the Bhagavatam saying that? We become introspective and grateful. If we don't have that situation, we express our thanks. And we realize that the only reason why we don't have that situation is because we have a chance to keep Krishna in the center and engage in Krishna's service. All right, any questions? Yes?
We say that, like, nicely explained, Atam Sadhama Moksha Kama Dalini, that is, no matter what desires you have, we should take shelter of Krishna. But at the same time, we hear that it's important to perform pure devotional service, because or chant purely, because until we perform pure devotional service or chant purely, then we're not going to get pure love of God. The intention with which we perform the devotional service is very important, because otherwise, depending on our desire, devotional service can lead us to the heavenly planets, it can lead us to Brahmaloka, but if you really want the love of Godhead, that intention has to be there. Can you please explain?
Well, you already explained.
At the same time, we say that it doesn't matter what desire you have, we should say it.
You can't see the bhakti therapy in such either-or terms. Just like, are you a married lady? Yes? So, as soon as you saw your future husband, you were like, you are the one. Was it like that? Arranged or not, still. When you first met him, it was not like, you know, the fireworks are going off in the sky, you know? Right? But gradually. Yes? A gradual immersion. Yes? So bhakti is like that. Why do we try to present bhakti in such a, an extreme, scary way? You either have no material desires or that's it. You can't. Krishna won't accept you. He just said in the purport, you heard from Chaitanya Charitamrita, if my devotee comes to me with material desires, I know how to handle it. I'll treat him in such a way that he or she will forget those desires and simply become attached to my lotus feet. That's what Krishna said. Why are we trying to turn Krishna into some kind of cold, sadistic creature? He's ready to smash us. We're just, like in some religions, we're just sinners in the hand of an angry God. Turn to him or burn.
In that verse, Prabhupada explains that it's special mercy that when Krishna destroys your desires,
No, no, no. He's referring that famous verse, Yasaham Anigranami Harishe Taddanam Shanai. When there's a special devotee who is attached to me and at the same time apparently attached to material life, I'll give my special mercy and I'll take away those things that are impeding the pure love. But you forget the other part of the verse and the other part of what Hari means. Hari means I take away what's impeding your pure love and I reward you with ecstatic love. So don't chop off the other half, you know. He just takes away. He just takes away. So bhakti is a transformative process. You'll read about that in Nectar of Devotion. There are different stages. Adoshadatatasarusangabhajanapriya anartanivritisa. On up to praying. Knowing that we cherish all devotees at all stages. Our bhakti community is like a... You didn't go to a one-room schoolhouse with all the grades in one room, did you? Some of you did, yes. In India, yes, they have these schools with several grades in one room. Yes. So we have members of the community on different levels. And hopefully they're making progress. And the way they make progress is to have the association of those who are progressive. That inspires others to also be progressive. It's all about association. That's why the acharyas explain that even when someone is speaking about Krishna, the effect will vary according to the potency of the speaker. If it's just a wonderful neophyte speaker, you'll get the effect of bhajana kriya. You'll be inspired to engage in Krishna service. If the devotee, the speaker, is a bit more advanced, you'll be inspired to anartha nivritti, the cleansing of the unwanted things. And if the speaker is very advanced, you'll be inspired to develop bhava. So this is why it's important that everyone has a chance to associate with Srila Prabhupada's books. Because there, by doing that, no matter what level you're on, you'll be inspired all the way up to the level of Krishna prema. So you might say, well, in my bhakti riksha, where are the advanced devotees? But everyone has a chance to associate with Srila Prabhupada through his books. And as you know, he said his books are the best way to associate with him. And he told us in Los Angeles that his books are for all levels of spiritual advancement, from the beginner to the Mahabhagavat. So according to your level, you'll see different things in Prabhupada's books. It's not that everyone is reading the same thing in all ways. Yes, you're reading the same words, but your realizations and even what you make of those words will be different according to your realization. Because you're dealing with spiritual subject matter. So finally, regarding your question, bhakti is transformative, it's therapeutic. Gradually, you're reviving your love for Krishna. There's the beginning stage, and there's the stage of more advancement, more advancement, more advancement. There's no limit to love. Just like when you reach the stage of praying, there's further stages beyond that. You're dealing with love. It's not a material thing. It's not like a material relationship. There's no limit to how the bhakti love expands. That's why we sing about the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. They're always pushing the limits. They're pushing out the limits of the ocean of transcendental bliss.
It's by association. You learn the proper intention which to perform emotional service. And so then you can learn that to perform or aspire to perform your emotional service by which you
can. By associating with devotees, you'll develop the desire to be more enthusiastic about Krishna service, to be more conscientious of how to act for Krishna's pleasure. Let's be more specific in our terminology. Otherwise we get kind of theological, and I'm not a good theologian. That's why I gave you the example about you and your own marriage. It wasn't like as soon as you met the person, it was the full potential of the relationship unfolding in 1 second. It was a gradual development. Actually, since you got me on the subject, I'll blame you for this. There's been a study of the classic Indian marriage versus the Western romance passion style of marriage when they do marry. So it's found, behavioral scientists have found, that the Indian marriages that are arranged start off at, in the first stage of the marriage, starts off at a very low level of intensity, and then slowly starts to rise until the eighth year, and then the eighth year, the full potential of the relationship has unfolded. So it's a very slow beginning. And of course, Westerners can't handle that. We want the fireworks right now. So the behavioral scientists have charted the development of Western relationships. I won't say marriage because, you know, it's old-fashioned. So the Western style of passion relationship starts off, woo! Real high, and then after 2 years, and by the time it gets to the 8 year mark, it's practically non-existent. So bhakti starts off, for the most part, gradually, slowly. There are examples of overnight 100% transformation. And they're listed in Nectar Devotion. But as Nectar Devotion teaches us, those examples are given in a way for us to understand they're extraordinary, they're not normal, but they're showing you what the full potential of bhakti is. Not that everyone's going to be an overnight sensation, but the potential is there. So if you can't be an overnight Mahabhagwat, then at least invest your whole life in the process. How long is your life? Hopefully, what's the average age of a woman in Australia? What is it? 80 or something? It's longer than men. So we hope. We don't know, but we hope that you have the full lifespan so that you can dedicate it for serving Krishna with more and more expertise. You started young, and you're so fortunate. And so, we have much to expect from you. Anything else? Yes?
Guru, you mentioned about, you know, the people who are coming to a point of material frustration, and they're at the crossroads, so where they can choose to go down the path of intoxication or material life, or they can come to Krishna consciousness. And you know, when they're at the point when they're trying to help them sort of choose a Krishna conscious path, they have these friends and relatives giving them the guidance of, you know, doing things otherwise. So I just wanted to ask a suggestion how we can be most effective in helping those people at that point.
Be understanding that the social pressure will be there. Like I was hearing last night, my friends, they ask, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You're in a cult. The understanding that that pressure is going to be there and be their friend as they go through those stages. Be personal. People are actually looking for a community, whether from India or from Australia. People are looking for a loving community. And in good association, you can tolerate anything. We need each other. So be there for them. They're actually looking for camaraderie, heartfelt relationships. So if they're at the point where their friends and relatives are starting to criticize them, what are you doing with your life? You're hanging with the Hare Krishna? What they're doing is weighing. Well, the family and friends say this and the devotees say that. Which is better? So you give them something better and that helps them make the step. Sometimes they can turn their whole family into becoming devotees. It's common in India. Sometimes it happens even in the West that family members become devotees. I've told before, one of my sisters, she was 14, watching me as I started entering into the full bhakti lifestyle. I didn't know it. I was 21, she was 14. I was just thought I was just doing my thing, you know. But she was watching. And in the space of almost 45 years, I practically have talked to her no more than a total of 10 minutes. But then, when she was 60 years old and a grandmother, retired, she's a fully practicing devotee. She started all of a sudden at the age of 60. She was going to some yoga school for learning yoga teacher training. And so part of the curriculum was that they asked you, you know the Indian thing, it's now transferred to the West. Pick whatever devata you like. And worship that. Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, Radha, Hanuman. Just pick one and develop your power of concentration in that way. It's all the same. It's all the same. So she told them, I should ask my brother. He's a Swami. Oh, your brother's a Swami. Wow, that's great. Yeah, just pick whatever icon, pick whatever personality you want. Hanuman, Shiva, this or that. And talk to your brother. Yeah, it's, you know, whatever. You know, bhakti, jnana, yoga. It's all just the same thing. So, yeah, we're happy that he's doing the Krishna thing. That's great. Someone else is doing the Shiva thing. That's also great. You just pick whatever you want, you know? I'm sure your brother will understand. All the paths lead to the same goal. So, she tried to find me to ask me, do all the paths lead to the same goal? And does it make a difference? Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, Radha, Hanuman? Because in the Western yoga world, the hodgepodge can be even more than in India. So she tried to find me. She asked my family members, most of whom are very strict Christians, how do I find my brother? We don't know. Anyway, she persevered and she got through to me. And now she chants all her rounds in the morning when, upon waking up, reads Bhagavatam every day. So you often don't know how things are going to turn out. I would have never expected this. Now she's lamenting, why did I wait till I'm 60? Why didn't I start when I was 14? We all lament like that. Why didn't I give more to Krishna at an earlier age? So in short, be there for these persons. Let them see that they can plug into a vibrant, caring community. And that will ease the pain of being outcast amongst persons they've known for years. It's not easy, but you have to be there for them and fill them with ecstatic prasad. Oh, you're feeling bad because your mates no longer want to hang out with you? Here, have some lasagna. Anything else? Yes, Bhakta Prabhu.
Just on this point of bhakti has some time before we actually have realization or experience Krishna's presence. There is a bit of a movement in today's society for people that are searching to use an intoxicant, psychedelic substance, to actually enhance that out-of-body experience. To the extent that even in our community there are some younger people that are feeling the path of bhakti is just taking too long for me to actually experience bhakti, Krishna. So let me take just a little bit of an intoxicant that actually enliven that bhakti. So in my hearing, I actually feel ecstasy.
You know, everyone heard what he said. I have to say that I was astonished to find this notion even amongst top-level academics. Yes, they talk about it guardingly and carefully, but they do talk about it. And of course, it's all part of being multicultural. It's all part of being open to experiences of the native traditions, and they package it in that way. So we patiently have to explain to those who think that such intoxicants will help them in their spiritual life is that nothing material will help what is spiritual. You'll just become more and more bewildered because those herbs, those drugs, they open up the mind's experience to other aspects of material existence that normally you wouldn't experience. And so you can really become bewildered by mistaking such delusions for something spiritual. You're opening up on the subtle plane, and the subtle plane contains so much more than what people normally can handle in their daily life. And so you think that's spiritual. Wow, I had this experience. I had that experience. It must be spiritual. It must be God. You're like a little kid, you know, lost in an amusement park and think, you know, this is the ultimate. Look, a roller coaster. Or this. Or... They have amusement parks in Melbourne? Yes. So you're a little kid wandering around and you think this is the ultimate. Whereas the adults, no, it's just an amusement park. It closes down at the end of the day. And you gotta leave. So yes, I've noticed, funny that you mentioned that, I've noticed even amongst top level academics, they've told me personally, because it's all part of anthropological exploration, you know, being open to the native peoples and their original culture. The herbs show us that Western empiricism isn't the only way. You take some of these drugs, these natural herbs, like some of the native shamans do, and you open up. And that's the way to really have a universal human experience. So yes, it's going on like that. And patiently explain to members of our community that nothing material will help your spiritual life. You'll just be, it's like you're looking through a kaleidoscope. When a little kid looks through a kaleidoscope, he or she thinks, oh, look at that. You turn the kaleidoscope, and as you hold up to the light, you see so many new images and patterns and colors, and wow, wow. How many of you used a kaleidoscope when you were kids? Yes. Even the ladies do, huh? But you don't do it now, right?
You know, it's just a cardboard or a plastic tube with pieces of a colored plastic at the end of it. So similarly, those persons who tune in with these psychedelics, these drugs or herbs, they're just looking through a kaleidoscope. And because they've never seen that kind of stuff before, they think it's spiritual. Same thing went on in the 60s with LSD. Now they just found a more aboriginal or more native supplements to take. And that makes it better. Anything else? Yes?
Well, you nicely mentioned about the body coming, creeping in, and it also touched upon the spiritual world, how this person serves Krishna in a different way.
Yes?
Now, at the moment, I don't know what my spiritual identity is, and I'm part of this body. How do I give this up without knowing what is in store for me? It's scary.
Servitude runs through all the relationships. So, as Lord Chaitanya told Sanatana Goswami, Jivera Sorupoi Krishnera Nityadas, you are the eternal servant of Krishna. That is no small realization. And in all the other rasas, Satya, Vatsalya, Madhurya, servitude is the common thread. By serving Mahaprabhu, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, by serving Mahaprabhu as a servant, the portal to all the other rasas opens up. By being the servant of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, that's the conduit for whatever rasa you're meant to be established in. So just be the servant of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Yes?
I can bring back to the first question. I just wanted a little clarification. Because we hear different instructions. Some senior devotees are saying, just when you're in material distress, just go in front of the Lord and you chant and you pray.
What's wrong with that?
Others say that, I'm just telling all the different. Others say...
Nothing wrong with feeling going in front of the deities and praying?
No, I'm saying all the three levels. The second, they say that it's okay to ask Krishna for help and pray to him when you think it's going to be an obstacle in your further progress. And another instruction is, don't take service from Krishna. Ask Krishna to give you the strength to deal with the material distress. So...
All sounds good to me. I'm so happy that you're coming before the deity and praying.
But there are three different levels of instruction.
Do it all. Be sincere, do it all, and Krishna will guide you. It's not all up to us. This is my point. Krishna is in your heart. He wants to help. You're not left to struggle on your own. As you become more and more mature in bhakti, you realize that Krishna is helping you. Otherwise, I know in the beginning you have this feeling that you're struggling on your own and where's Krishna? Krishna doesn't understand, and but you still have to serve him and you grit your teeth and... Somehow or other approach Krishna and ask, we're hearing right in the verse. Ami vigya e murke vishoy kene jiva. The Lord understands the devotee. Okay, you got that. Who hesitates to engage in the Lord's service. Krishna knows our hesitations. And he'll help. So yes, go before the deity and pray. Please help. I have this hesitation, that hesitation. I have this anxiety, that anxiety. And Krishna will help you. Just like when your children would come to you and ask for help, would you criticize them? Why are you coming to me with that attitude? You'd be so happy they're coming to you for help. So Krishna is very grateful. He appreciates your coming to him. And you ask for his help. How can I present myself in the best way? Is this proper? I would like this, I would like that. Is it proper? Please arrange that I understand how best to approach you. And Krishna listens. Just like Prabhupada taught us during his departure, pre-departure days, to approach Krishna. My dear Lord Krishna, if you so desire, please cure Srila Prabhupada. So we're expressing our humanity. We want him to stay. At the same time, we recognize that Krishna's will is the best. But because we're spiritual beings having a human experience, I think this is what I'm trying to get at today. We can't deny our humanity. Bhakti is not some kind of cold, sterile path that you pay no attention to humanity. You're a spiritual being having a human experience. You're not a human being having a spiritual experience. So Krishna understands. And present yourself in that way. Just like Prabhupada taught us. My dear Lord Krishna, if you so desire, please cure Srila Prabhupada. We are expressing our preference, at the same time expressing that Krishna knows best. Okay? Doesn't that sound very very doable? Okay, thank you. I don't want to get involved in all, you know, the theological adjusting this and adjusting that. Let's focus on what's doable. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.